How big a deal is it that I get angry? It's the question on the handouts. It's where we're starting this morning. How big a deal is it that I get angry? And yes, we know the biblical answer is it's a really big deal. We literally just read the passage on the subject, didn't we? Only we don't feel that it's a really big deal very often, do we? Especially not when it's my anger. Yours, well, that is a problem. But mine, my anger's justified. If anything, I like to think of it as righteous anger, because I kind of have a right to be angry. Or at least my anger is someone else's fault. You know, they provoked me. They sinned against me. And yes, I know, two wrongs don't make a right. But they kind of did have it coming to them. And yes, okay, I do feel ashamed now. I think back to what I said. And I do wish I hadn't overreacted. And I literally cannot look Elspeth in the eye since she overheard me swearing down the phone as aggressively as I was when we both passed each other in Lidl. But you know what? I'm only human. And my anger isn't that bad in the grand scheme of things. And we all have our weaknesses. And it's not like I've murdered anyone, is it? How big a deal is it that I get angry? And the reading we just read, Jesus' words from Matthew 5, they come in and they hit like a sledgehammer, don't they? And the first point this morning, even anger has no place in Jesus' kingdom. Even anger has no place in his kingdom. And for those of us who have been here since we started looking through Matthew's account of Jesus' life, do we remember that in chapters 1 to 4, the first four chapters, Matthew has been doing this comparison between Israel in the Old Testament and Jesus. And he's had Jesus retracing the steps of Israel, the nation, back in the first five books of the Old Testament. And he's saying that Jesus is the true Israel that Old Testament Israel was pointing forwards to. And we may remember that we've been saying that he performs the perfect action replay of everything Israel did. Where Israel went wrong, not doing what they should do, Jesus gets it right. The perfect action replay. And so here in chapter 5, the true Israel, Jesus, well, he sets up his new Israel of Jewish followers, shaped in his likeness. So in 5 verse 1, if we look back to 5 verse 1, we see that Jesus is taking his disciples onto a mountain. Just as God in the Old Testament took his people Israel to Mount Sinai. And here on the mountain, Jesus sets out the standards for life in his new community, just as in the Old Testament, God at Sinai, Mount Sinai, had set out the standards for his new community, Israel. The true Israel is gathering about him his new Israel and setting out standards for life in the community. And last week we saw that Jesus said he's by no means demolishing the Old Testament, but rather he's fulfilling it. And in verse 20, the verse before where we are reading today, in verse 20, he takes a swipe at the Pharisees with their fake righteousness, saying that his new Israel, this new kingdom, is to be a place of true righteousness and obedience from the heart, not like old Israel with Pharisaical false righteousness. And in the next little sections with the little headings, anger, lust, and so on, in these next six sections, he's going to look back to the Old Testament law and draw out this contrast between the Pharisees' false righteousness and the true righteousness that is to mark out his kingdom. That he is making a contrast is clear if you just look through the verses. So under where it says anger, verse 21, you've heard that it was said of to those of old. But verse 22, but I say to you, contrast. Go to 27, verse 27. You've heard that it was said, verse 28, but I say to you. Verse 31, it was also said, verse 32, but I say to you, and so on. And I just want us to get clear straight up that Jesus isn't having a pop at the Old Testament law here. Don't forget, he just said in verse 17 that he hasn't come to abolish the law and the prophets, but rather fulfill them. No, out with old Israel doesn't mean out with God's Old Testament, but rather Jesus is making a contrast between his kingdom standards and the Pharisee standards. That contrast in verse 20, your righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees, because it's not real righteousness. And he's going to keep on making that contrast all the way through chapter 6 as well. That's why in verse 21, he doesn't say, as Exodus said, or as Moses said, or as the Old Testament law said, but rather he says, you've heard that it was said. One of the commentators said that it's like he's saying, you understand that. As the Pharisees go back the Old Testament law and they teach you how it applies today, they say. And that's why in verse 21, you don't just get the commandment, but you get this added bit that the second half of 21, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. That's not actually there in the Ten Commandments, but that's part of the teaching of the Pharisees to Israel. And in the coming weeks, again and again, Jesus is going to make this contrast so that we can understand, so that they can understand, we can understand that the true standard of righteousness in his kingdom is way beyond anything they could imagine. This is the true standard of righteousness that the Old Testament and the prophets, they always pointed towards, that's fully revealed in him, and that he then calls for in his kingdom that's shaped in his likeness, as true Israel gathers new Israel. And the point is to show how radically and stunningly pure Jesus' kingdom will be. As Sam said last week, it is to set out for us the most beautiful roadmap for his disciples to follow. A righteousness that's so glorious, it lies in stark contrast even to the best of the world's self-righteous alternatives. Okay, so let's dive into that first contrast there, 21 and 22. You've heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. I say to you, everyone who is angry at his brother will be liable to judgment. Jesus is saying even anger has no place in his kingdom. I thought it's probably worth saying that it isn't to be taken for granted that murder would be banned by any national ruler or legal system. You know, I've been thinking about this as I've been horrified for the people of Ukraine and their suffering. But then remembering how limited and fickle I am in my concern for others, in my concern for those suffering in the world, and thinking how regularly I kid myself into thinking that it's abnormal that people's human rights, basic rights, might be under threat. I was thinking, actually, the thing that I don't realise is how many millions of people wake up every single morning knowing that if they were to be murdered, the authorities would either turn a blind eye, or do nothing if they were bunged a bribe, or worse still, how many millions of people woke up this morning, with the threat of state-sanctioned murder on their life. And we're so safe and secure in our minds here in Britain, aren't we, that I don't think we can even begin to get our heads around that reality. But it is a reality for many. You know, it's not to be taken for granted that you shall not murder. But, thankfully, in Israel, ever since their beginning as a nation, that was taken for granted. That was very clear because God had given it to them in the Ten Commandments. God's righteous law had been given to them, and they knew that you shouldn't murder. And as a result, the self-righteous Pharisees, well, they can feel great about themselves as they're teaching God's law to Israel. They speak against murder. They speak against murderers and the nations all around where no one realises what a wicked thing that is. Thinking themselves righteous because they had never done the physical act and delighting, presumably, as we do in our self-righteousness, when they got the opportunity to point the finger at others and do that verse 21 judging of those who had committed murder. Oh, disgusting them. Liable to judgment them. But Jesus takes that idea of not murdering, the idea that not murdering is enough to be righteous, and he blows it out of the water. He says that such a limited understanding hasn't even begun to grasp what true righteousness looks like. Verse 22. I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. You know, sure, your anger may not have filled over into a physical act of aggression, and so you can't be charged, you can't be condemned guilty by an earthly Jewish court. But God sees into our heart, and in his blazing purity, he sees the full wickedness of our thoughts, our feelings and intentions as we rage internally. And he says that is enough to condemn us in the heavenly courtroom. That moment when your spouse forgets the one thing you asked them to pick up on the way home. Or your boss belittles you in front of the whole team. Or when your mum says those cruel words because she knows how much they'll sting. Or when you come home exhausted and your flatmate has left their dirty dishes in the sink yet again. Or when someone barges past you on the escalator and then has the audacity to give you a dirty look and you don't say anything because you're worried they might be violent, but in your head you just switch. And maybe you even begin to mouth that first F, but you don't say it out loud because you're terrified that you might get beat up if you do. But inside, Jesus says that our anger in those moments is born out of our sinful hearts. You know, not to deny at all the sinfulness of those who wrong us, but then we add our own sin into the mix too. Unlike Jesus, who as the eternal God did not retaliate when his own creatures who he was sustaining and keeping alive in that very moment, spat on him, beat him, nailed him to a tree. What I would have done if I were him in that moment, and instead he asked that they be forgiven. That is true righteousness. He is true righteousness, and our anger exposes us for our lack of righteousness. And in Jesus' kingdom, the home of perfect righteousness, even anger has no place. He emphasises in verse 22 three times just how deserving of judgment he finds our anger to be. I say to you, everyone who's angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Insults his brother will be liable to the council. Whoever says you fool will be liable to the hell of fire. And my standards of righteousness are so much lower than this one, than the one that we're reading here, that if I'm honest, even as someone who has trusted Jesus for over 15 years, I still find that really difficult to believe. So difficult to believe that my outbursts of anger are worthy of hell. But Jesus knows that sinful anger comes from sinful hearts. And they're evidence of the fact that in our natural state or in that moment, we've rejected God, his rules. And Jesus says he won't tolerate that in his kingdom. In fact, Jesus says he's so committed to eradicating anger that we know in the Bible that he will fully eradicate that in us in the future as he returns to bring about his perfect new creation. He'll rid us of all sin, including anger. And at the cross, he died for our anger so that we might not have to face judgment. You know, I think of all the things that I think Jesus had to die for me. You know, all the sins I've committed that he willingly took the punishment for. I very rarely realise that my anger is so serious that he literally took it to the cross to save me of the judgment of hell. Even anger has no place in his kingdom. And notice too that Jesus says twice in verse 22 the word brother or brother and sister. And I don't think he's just talking about arguments between siblings in such a way that, you know, I can relax because I'm an only child. No, we've seen repeatedly, we've said already in the last few weeks repeatedly that this is 5 verse 1, Jesus teaching his disciples. And he says to them that God is their heavenly Father. We're going to see that lots in chapter 6. God is the heavenly Father of those who follow Jesus. And Jesus says that we're his brothers and sisters in this new family. God as Father, Jesus as our elder brother, us as brothers and sisters. And as he sets out the roadmap for life in this kingdom, he says that there's no room even for anger in God's new family, amongst God's children. He says he has no time for us to be angry with one another, with other brothers and sisters here at Crossway. I don't know about you, but after just these two verses, just 21 and 22, don't we already feel exposed for how desperately we fall short of Jesus' true standards? You know, Jesus has brought us exactly where we need to be if we're going to see ourselves in the first verses of chapter 5, if we're going to recognise that we are those to whom he's speaking in the Beatitudes. 5 verse 3, blessed are the poor in spirit. And just after 21 and 22, how spiritually poor are we in comparison to him? Or verse 4, you know, how much have I got to mourn over my anger, even from the last week? Verse 5, blessed are the meek. I mean, how can I be proud after what we've just heard and look at my own life, thinking of how regularly I rage? Verse 6, as I think about what a wretch I am in comparison to him, don't I hunger and thirst for righteousness? I long to be more like Jesus, to be like the truly righteous one. I would love to be free from the anger that boils up daily. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. And thankfully, as followers of Jesus, we do not need to fear that our anger will lead to our condemnation. Rather, we can be blessed because he has died in our place. And so as we seek his forgiveness, he says, ours is the kingdom of heaven. We are those who are forgiven, trusting in Jesus, and so will be with him in heaven. But as we find ourselves as brothers and sisters in his kingdom, you know, this is the roadmap that we're to follow. We are to walk in his righteous footsteps. And look, I know what I've just said is heavy. What Jesus says to us is heavy, given how readily we find ourselves getting angry. But even at this point, I thought, aren't we thankful that we do now have the opportunity to live differently in his kingdom? You know, how wonderful it is to have a vision for my pathetic little life that says the aim isn't to be content with not murdering. That's not the standard I'm to aspire to. Rather, Jesus is calling us to a future life in which I'm able to have someone wrong me and to have my response to them be dictated not by my anger, but by a Holy Spirit-empowered decision to love. Even anger has no place in Jesus' kingdom. And the next four verses, I don't think they provide much new dense theology. Rather, I think they just show how Jesus' kingdom is to be even more anti-anger than we've just seen so far. Even more anti-anger than verse 22. And so our second point on the handouts, reconcile with those you've angered with as soon as possible. Jesus says that even anger has no place in his kingdom. So we are to reconcile with those we've angered as soon as possible. Verse 23. So if you're offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Jesus here, he's taking his hearers in their mind's eye into the temple in Jerusalem. And he has them imagine that they've gone to offer a sacrifice to God. You know, we no longer have to do that this side of Jesus' death because he paid his life as the ultimate sacrifice. But at that point in history, that was what a good Jewish believer would do, because Jesus is obviously talking before he's died here. They're to seek forgiveness from God for their sin, wanting to be restored to a right relationship with him. You know, that is reconciled to him. And Jesus says to them, if you find yourself in the temple, at the very altar itself, you know, you've already bought the sacrifice, and it's literally just about to be offered by the priest, and there you remember that you are not in a right relationship, not reconciled to a brother or sister, shout for the priest to stop. Call the sacrifice off. Leave the gift there and go. First, he says, be reconciled to your brother or sister before coming back to be reconciled to God. That's how big a deal it is that Jesus' followers eradicate anger from their communities. And I didn't plot this at first, but as you read verse 23, do you see that Jesus isn't actually speaking here still about moments where I'm angry and I'm shouting at my brother? Rather, verse 23, if you remember that your brother has something against you. So it's not that I'm raging against you and I think, oh, I can't offer this sacrifice, I'm too angry, I have to go and sort this out. Rather, I remember that I've done something to anger you and you're seething against me. So it's not my anger, it's your anger. But I remember that I've created this anger within you. I've been part of this broken relationship. You're left angry and I'm to be so concerned by that, that God would rather I came to resolve the issue with you. He'd rather that I humbled myself before you and try and help you be free from that anger that I've caused, that anger that's liable to judgment. He'd rather that I helped you be free from that than that I turned to enjoy my relationship with him. And if that wasn't in the Bible, I think I would think that's heresy. Because obviously the most important thing is my relationship with God, right? Nothing's more important than that. Only Jesus says that there is one thing that is as important as that. And that's that we deal with any anger that there is between us. Anger in you that I may have helped to bring about. Reconcile with those you've angered as soon as possible. And then a guy called Don Carson, you may know Don Carson, Canadian, isn't he? Lives in America. But he helped me. I was reading something he's written, helped me see that in Jesus is probably talking to those who are in Galilee, which is northern Israel, and he's speaking to them about the temple, which is in southern Israel, in Jerusalem. So 4:18, Jesus is in by the Sea of Galilee. And again in 4:23, he goes throughout all Galilee. And it's there 5:1 where he sees the crowd, then goes up on a mountain, presumably still in Galilee. And he's talking to them about the fact that if they have travelled 140 kilometres down to the temple, if they've gone all the way down, 3-day journey, down to the temple, most of them on foot in those days. He says, if there, after that 140-kilometre walk, they're about to offer their sacrifice and they remember that they've had an argument with someone who's still angry at them, rather than thinking, okay, in 3 days' time when I get back, I've got to make sure that I sort that out pronto. He says, no, 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 stop what you're doing, even at the very altar, put the sacrifice down, make the 140-kilometre journey back up to Galilee, sort that out with your brother or sister, and then make the 140-kilometre journey back down to do the sacrifice before again making the journey back home. Now, Jesus is saying, guys, if you're at the altar and you remember that you've got a problem between you and your brother and sister, they're angry at you, I'm really sorry, you're going to have to call in sick for the next week. Commit to resolving the issue instantly. Don't wait until you've given the sacrifice to then go home. And at that point, I still think that Jesus' commitment to eradicate anger from his community, from his disciples, it's still alien to my worldview. In fact, I kind of think Like, you know, oh, come on. You're just exaggerating to make the point, surely, Jesus. But then in the next two verses, rather than being like, okay, guys, maybe that's a bit too much, you know, maybe three times 140K just to say sorry before you give your sacrifice, maybe that's a bit too far. Rather than doing that, Jesus says, oh, let me just reinforce the point in verses 25 and 26. He backs it up further, again highlighting how quickly the issue needs to be resolved. Verse 25, come to terms quickly. Don't delay. And he uses the image of you being in debt to someone and they're taking you to court for the debt that you owe them. And the point is that in the image, you literally have until you get to the court to resolve this. Because once you get to the courtroom, it's too late. You'll find yourself imprisoned and you'll be imprisoned until you've paid back the very last penny. And I don't think Jesus is saying this as a threat, a literal threat to us. Who are trusting in him. Thankfully, we don't need to fear that we'll be punished. I think that's key. We don't need to fear that we'll be punished for the debt that we owe to one another and God. You know, Jesus has taken that punishment instead. Rather, I think Jesus is using the illustration to highlight the urgency that he wants us to have when we've wronged one another, when we've caused a brother or sister to be angry. Reconcile with those you've angered as soon as possible. And it doesn't take long to run through possible scenarios in our mind before we begin to see how much pride swallowing, like living like this, would involve for us at Crossway. You know, the idea that you and I would have an argument, we'd both walk off in a bit of a huff, and then each would wait for the other to swallow their pride and come and apologise for the things they'd done wrong. Because good luck if you think I'm going to be the first one to humiliate myself before you. I mean, you've got a lot to say sorry for. And until you do, yeah, let's just keep our distance. Or I was thinking, even if I knew that I was mainly in the wrong, my tactic would be, I don't really want to have to humiliate myself. I don't want to face the awkwardness of the conversation. I want to save face. So I'll probably just ignore you for the next few weeks at church. And then maybe in like 3-4 weeks' time, I'll see you when we're hanging around with 5 other people and I'll just try and make some funny jokes and wave my arms around a lot and be a bit of an idiot and try and put a smile on your face. And hopefully by then you'll kind of forget that you were ever angry at me at all and we can just move on and pretend nothing happened. But Jesus says, rather than doing that, rather than leaving it to fester or hoping it will just go away, he says, at the moment we reflect on what we've done, that very moment we realise that we've got a brother or sister who might be angry at us, we're to seek forgiveness for any way in which we have wronged one another. Because my pride or my comfort, they're not what I'm to be concerned about in Jesus' kingdom. Rather, we as a community are to have this total commitment to being free from anger. Reconcile with those you've angered as soon as possible. And we have to be careful with verses like this, don't we? That we by no means use them to excuse abusive behaviour. This doesn't mean that when we experience abuse, we just accept threats or violence. And it doesn't mean asking for forgiveness when in fact we have been wronged. That is one of the hallmarks of abuse, isn't it? That we have been wronged and yet we feel like we are the ones in the wrong. We're told, the abuser tells us, that we're the one who should be saying sorry. No, the Bible is really clear that abuse in all its forms is wickedness, and God has given us the authorities to dispense justice when crimes are committed. We don't have to excuse abuse. And it's worth saying that if your anger is so out of control that people feel threatened in your presence, if they have just cause to feel threatened in your presence, then you have to get that sorted out now. Absolutely no place for that. It must be dealt with, even if it has real earthly consequences. Because Jesus has absolutely no time for that. But here, Jesus isn't dealing with those extreme scenarios. That's why we've not been talking about them. Here, he focuses, verse 22, on the everyday situations of insults, of calling someone a fool. And he's focusing on that because his point is, he's so extreme in his anti-anger propaganda, anti-anger agenda, probably a better way of saying it, that he says even those more socially acceptable moments of anger, well, they're unacceptable in his kingdom. And so we're to reconcile with those we've angered as soon as possible. As Christians, we're convinced that Jesus will return in the future to establish this perfect kingdom that we've seen a glimpse of, to establish this perfect kingdom fully and finally on earth. Then, the Bible says, he will rid the world of all unrighteousness. And those who have trusted in him will live in a world perfectly free from anger. And if we're not Christians this morning, that may sound impossible to believe. You know, as Christians, we also struggle, don't we, to think it's really coming. But doesn't this vision of Jesus' kingdom at least make us long for it to be true? A place with no violence, no road rage, no windows smashed, no cowering, no trembling, no cruel words, no swear words, no families divided, no bitterness or grudges. Everyone willing to swallow their pride at the drop of a hat for the sake of peace in the community. The anger that darkened too many of our childhoods, that has ruined some of our most precious relationships, it will be banished forever. Jesus says he'll have absolutely none of it in his perfect kingdom. And all of our anger that we have to be ashamed of, you know, that which wells up within us and spews out of us, the things that I have thought and said in anger that I am so pleased that you don't know about, Jesus says on that day he will finally free us, rid us of it forever. Because anger has no place in his kingdom. And even before he comes to take us home, even now, in the here and now, isn't that the kind of community that we long to be here at Crossway? You know, don't verses 23 and 24 give the most heartwarming vision of church? Even in our sinfulness, don't we see its beauty? And in our weakness, aren't we ready to commit to living this kind of anger-extinguishing love with one another? Even anger has no place in Jesus' kingdom. So reconcile with those you've angered as soon as possible.